Sorry, colleagues. Senator Hansel and I were down smiting a bad bill together, and
I'm going to call the this meeting of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development to order. Today is the 9th of March, and I apologize for the delay, but I think we had a couple of senators that were tied up in testimony in another hearing. So we are going to open the public hearing again on House Bill 5025, Oregon Business and Development Department. Mr. Harder, I'll invite you to bring your wrap-up team forward, and I'll call on Mr. Bender to give us a quick update of where we're at.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There are items on all lists for today's meeting, actually on two meeting dates. If you go back to Monday's meeting date, we continue to post OBDD's presentation, which you see on the screen. If you're following, they're on slide 128. There's also a separate presentation on Monday's date that is labeled the OFVO presentation. That's the Oregon Film and Video Office presentation. And then for today's date, there is the DAS presentation that Mr. Heath will be covering. I also want to note very briefly that the agency did respond to some questions that you had for them yesterday on distressed areas, the Oregon Investment Advantage Program, and on 5G wireless. There is an item in today's OLIS posting of their responses to those questions.
All right, I'll also indicate we've got about 16 or 17 people that are signed up to testify. We're expecting a representative to join us at about 1:30 as well. So we're going to move as quickly as we can. I've got some people that have traveled a long way to be with us, and I do want to be respectful of them, so I'll call on them first. But overall, while you're thinking about the time that you're going to have to come forward, we're going to have about an hour's time to take testimony. We'll try and stay longer if we're at all able to, and that means that we'll be looking probably at about 3 to 5 minutes per person. So let's go ahead and get started. Mr. Harder, we are most of the way through your formal presentation. Let's wrap it up.
Very close, Chair Gomberg. Thank you, and committee members. I'm going to turn it over quickly to Ramona Rademacher, who's going to talk about our operations and administrative side of the organization. Obviously, we've been focusing on the external, but that is equally important to how we run our organization.
Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ramona Rademacher, and the Assistant Director for Operations and Finance for Business Oregon. I'm going to talk today briefly about the last section of our budget, and that is the Operations and Administration section. This section would be called in other agencies, central services, business services, things like that. It includes three major areas, the first being the director's office of the department. That office provides leadership, strategic direction, oversees our Oregon Business Development Commission, and does legislative liaison work. There are three FTE total in our director's office. The second component of this area is our equity strategies and communication unit. They provide research and economic analysis, and they do outreach and marketing to Oregon companies to tell them about our programs, and they also do outreach to companies seeking to do business in Oregon. So it's much more of an external customer-based outreach and marketing function than an internal communications type thing. And lastly, we have our operations or business services, and that is exactly as you'd expect: finance, accounting, HR, information technology, purchasing, and facilities. There's one final component that's actually located in the Operations and Finance Division, and that's the business finance area that you heard from yesterday. I'm specifically not talking about them today because John Saris covered that yesterday, and I also just wanted to point out that that particular unit is 100% self-funded. And so everything that happens in the business finance unit is paid for by loan payments and fees to people using the service. Overall, this administration section, the total budget for the three areas is $8.8 million. This is less than 1% of the total agency budget. When you're looking at other agency budgets, you'll typically see that number much higher in the 6 to 10% range. Operations and administration is predominantly lottery funded, and it's also almost entirely personnel services. And so when we take lottery fund cuts, necessarily a lot of times they do occur in this area. Despite the, I talked a couple of days ago about there's a 49% growth in our governor's recommended budget. But a lot of the cuts that occur, because this is where the lottery funds are, happen here, which is a loss of capacity and ability to provide operational support. It hits the management of the department, economic strategies and policy, information technology, facilities, accounting, and our equity and outreach components. Our equity strategy and communication unit, basically our organizational realignment and our strategic planning continue to emphasize the need to do better support rural areas and to provide services to underserved populations. Also, we hear routinely about the need to make research-based policy and investment decisions and to work with Oregonians to let them know about our programs and the benefits of doing business in Oregon. Again, how the 12% cuts hit here is rather heavy. There are 10 FTE in this section, and this and the 12% cuts do take out 3.5 of those positions, thus reducing some capacity. And lastly, the operations unit. This includes things like for the budget and accounting unit, the financial management, the management of all of our bond programs, budget development, payroll, and things like that. There is less of a difference in our agency because of the type of work that we do between operations and programs at time, and that's just because we're oftentimes in the business of money management. So the same accountant that does our travel and our spots card reconciliations is the accountant that's also doing the management of our strategic reserve fund reports and tracking our pipeline and things like that. So we blend across program and operations quite a bit here. And then most of these others are self-explanatory. Employee services is your typical recruitment, performance management, affirmative action, things like that. Information technology is the whole gamut from hardware, software, and project management. And purchasing and facilities are also self-explanatory. There, in the 12% reduction, there is about a 10% reduction in staff in the operations support part of the department as well. And that, again, is just because it's very heavily personnel-based, and there's really no other way to take the reductions here. Overall in this area, it may not sound like a lot to have a loss of 8 staff, but that is actually 6% of our entire department being reduced. And so the effect of the loss of general management and operational support is significant because it does impact our ability to do internal controls and manage risk. And that pretty much concludes our operations and administration section.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rodemaker. Mr. Harder.
Chair Gomberg, committee members, want to quickly close our presentation that we've been doing over the last 4 days. To conclude our presentation, I'd like to end with a summary of the impact of our work, which is community and infrastructure development, business retention, expansion and recruitment, global trade, innovation, and the arts. The point of this slide is to reinforce our impact in ensuring prosperity for all Oregonians. We've provided some of the impacts on over the last 2 years on the screen before you. At Business Oregon, we invest in communities, businesses, and people. We helped stand up new industries like UAVs and cross-laminated timber and invest in research and development. We keep drinking water safe and rebuild schools to protect from earthquakes. We work to support small businesses and help them grow. And we target company expansion and attraction opportunities to create quality jobs around the state. We do this all with a relatively small agency, efficiently working with partners in every corner of the state. I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to present this week.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harder. Are there any questions for this panel? Then why don't we bring Mr. Williams up, and then we'll hear from Mr. Heath, and then we'll move to public testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Williams. I'm the executive director of Oregon Film, the state film and media office. I have some slides, I think.
Mr. Williams, how many slides do you have for us today?
It's 10 or 12.
Okay. Can we move this efficiently?
I will do my best, yes. I would love to make a case for not having our budget cut as much as it is, but I will do my endeavor to do my best, absolutely.
Well, I think the quicker you go, the more money you may get.
That's a deal.
No promises.
Maybe not. Huh. Yeah, I sent the PowerPoint. It's on all of us. Does that matter? I sent it in earlier. While this goes up, I can sort of start. Oregon Film is an agency, a semi-independent state agency that exists to promote Oregon's creative content industry, both here in the state and both outside of the state. And we look to heighten the Oregon's creative industry and make sure that we operate on a dual approach, both to make sure in-state companies continue to grow and make sure out-of-state companies come in and stay and spend their money here. As I said, we're a semi-independent state agency. We operate with a four-person full-time staff with a biennium budget last biennium of $1.164 million. We're the coordinating point throughout the state for all inquiring projects. We coordinate with other agencies. We coordinate with permits. We coordinate with a large location database for photographs and scouts that are going on here, as well as having a robust social media presence of about 10,000 followers on Twitter. Thank you, Steve. 3,000 followers on Facebook and an active blog and newsletter with 8,000 different subscribers. Moving on. Okay. These are the slides. Am I doing this wrong, Steve? Oh, there we go.
Is that okay?
Yep, you're good. We also administer the film and media incentive programs here in the state, the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF, as well as the Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate Program. As part of the larger OPIF program, we also manage what is called the Indigenous IOPIF program, which is focused on Oregon producers and Oregon companies and smaller Oregon-based projects. As well, in the coming year, we're going to start what's called a regional OPIF program for encouraging projects outside of the Portland metro area, which is called an ROPIF program. Sorry for all the acronyms. That will be coming into effect on July 1 of this year. In the fiscal year 2015-2016, Oregon Film tracked about $170 million of in-state spending on 26 different projects and 300 commercial productions. These projects range from Oscar-nominated features to Sundance Award-winning feature films, Emmy Award-winning TV series, as well as interactive game titles, visual effects, and national and international commercial campaigns. Many Oregon projects stayed here and grew their companies and labor forces, and we brought in outside projects that spent their money here over the course of several years with TV series. This year, we actually commissioned two different economic development reports. These reports were done by the U of O, the Community Service Center, as well as the Northwest Economic Research Center at PSU. Both are available on OLIS as well as on our site if you would like to review them. I would just like to highlight one thing that came out of the NERC report, which is in addition to the estimated annual average of 1,500 jobs provided directly by incentivated projects and businesses, the indirect and induced impacts of this industry activity supports another 1,600 1,700 jobs elsewhere in the Oregon economy. Likewise, the resulting income paid to Oregon workers on incentivized projects since 2012 averaged $149 million per year, $93.5 million directly paid by media productions, another $55 million supported indirectly by industry activity and consumer purchases. Total value added to the industry economy over the last 5 years has averaged $193 million per year since 2012, 83% of that going to Oregon residents. This is primarily a small business economy, as is reflected in the U of O research that they've done. Annual gross revenue of media-related activities reported by the respondents of the U of O survey showed that their average income ranged from $400 to $25 million. Two-thirds of the respondents reported revenues of less than $100,000, and 16% reported revenues of more than $1 million. I'd also like to quickly highlight a project that came in last year that utilized our incentive programs called Lean on Pete. Lean on Pete shot last year from August to October. It was written based on a book by Oregon author Willie Vlaughton, starred Steve Buscemi and Chloe Sevigny. It shot in North Portland, Malala, and also in Harney County. It hired 220 local crew and 125 local vendors and had an impact on more than half of the legislative map. In fact, it spent more than $100,000 alone in hotels in Harney County during its stay out there for 3 weeks. Also, I wanted to highlight the animation economy that's going on here in Oregon, led by the winning work of Leica. Oregon is now home to a world-class animation studios providing full-time jobs here in the state with good salaries. The state has now become a destination for high-caliber animation talent, and it continues to expand its workforce and creative output. In the past year alone, Oregon made animation projects have won awards and invented new animation techniques, leading to Leica Studios becoming only the second animation house in history to be nominated for a visual effects award with the Academy Awards. On their own, these companies annually employ more than 450 people and generate more than $70 million in revenue here in the state. Many Oregon-made products here have been celebrated both here at film festivals as well as nationwide, from a Sundance Award-winning feature in an Oregon room that we had at Sundance this year, to a global game jam in Portland, premieres in Los Angeles, and homegrown internationally to game development in Newburgh, Eugene, and Oregon City. Oregon now is associated with high-profile creative projects from around the world. I'm editing as I go, Chair Gumberg. I'm just best my ability. One of the great things we also try to do is community building. And what I'm showing you here is a map of many of the over 200 events that we either sponsored or attended or helped in direct and indirect ways over the last year. This is a sort of major part of what we do. And from places like Astoria to Coos Bay to the Power Theater in Bend to various other places that we've been over the last year, this is something that we take great pride in. In fact, one project that I wanted to highlight that we did in conjunction with Travel Oregon and the Hollywood Theater was a tour of Buster Keaton's The General, which was shot in 1926 in Cottage Grove. We took that out on tour in Portland, in Coos Bay, in Bend, in Klamath Falls, and we actually had an outdoor screening of it to more than 1,500 people in Cottage Grove where the film was shot this past summer. The film actually featured a brand new score that was written by an Oregon-based composer named Mark Orton, who's actually been nominated for several different awards. Also, this past year, we partnered with a 501c3 called the Oregon Charitable Fund to create what is called the Oregon Media Creative Foundation. And the purpose of this program is to hopefully create merchandise and funding under the Oregon-made brand. This Oregon-specific branding effort hopes to raise money for smaller indigenous projects which are not normally part of the state's incentive programs, and it's these projects where many of our earliest talent is starting. Our office is not only developed and set up the site as well as the merchandise for this Oregon-made effort. We've also trademarked the logo as a way to expand the recognition of Oregon's creativity throughout the world. This logo is also now appearing in end crawls and packaging for Oregon-made creative projects that we're creating here. As part of this effort, Oregon Film arranged and opened a six-month exhibit at PDX Airport celebrating the film and TV history here, which more than 1 million people have seen over the last 6 months. In addition, this past summer, we also ran a small job shadow program on many of the sets here in the state, including Grimm, Portlandia, The Librarians, and Hive Effects of the FX Company. These five students spent time working next to crew and learning how different departments worked. We then videotaped these entire interactions, and after completions of the job shadows, we edited these down into episodes, and we've made those episodes available to high school media programs around the state as a teaching tool. As far as I know, those five students are still working in the business. In fact, three of them have come together to create their own production company lately. Sadly, Grimm has come to an end here after 123 episodes and 6 years and more than $300 million of in-state spending. They ended their final episode shooting in an ice storm at Happy Valley in Estacada. On top of that, the dedicated cast was so invested in Oregon that they actually held an annual fundraiser for the Dornbecker Children's Hospital. This year, they actually raised more than $800,000 in less than 3 hours, which came to more than $1.5 million raised over the last 3 years, which helped support the families of children being treated at the Dornbecker Hospital, which is what's called the Grimster Endowment. We're now working very hard to try to replace Grimm with one or even more productions. Lastly, I wanted to just speak a little bit to our proposed budget. The 15% cut, which was 15% cut off our current service level, is taken from the governor's recommended budget. With this proposed cut, we would not only be at the lowest budget level we've been at for the last 12 years, it will also require a cut of almost all of the extracurricular work that I've gone over here today. In total, this cut would amount to approximately $90,000 per fiscal year and would specifically lead to the reduction or negation of all the community building, education, and workforce development programs we have, as well as reductions in event sponsorship coordination, in-state community building, out-of-state travel, essentially zero allocation for marketing and promotion, and new business recruitment. A full payroll freeze for 2 years, as well as a complete cut of any part-time help and special projects would also occur. And looking ahead, we're tracking about 30 projects for this fiscal year, as well as $180 million of in-state spend, not to mention another $20 to $25 million of commercial production that is going on. We're looking forward to the release of Lean on Pete, as well as the Sundance Film Festival award-winning I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, as well as Trackdown from Eugene, The Watchman's Canoe from Coos Bay, Seaside from Arch Cape. They'll all be coming in this next year coming up. Several interactive game titles will also be released in this coming year, including titles from Pipeworks in Eugene, Fulbright in Portland, Super Genius in Oregon City, and Jump Drive Studios in Newburgh. I'd like to thank you, Chair Gomberg, and the members of the committee for letting me have this time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Mr. Williams, I appreciate your efficient presentation of that report. And please know that this committee absolutely recognizes the many contributions that your division is making to Oregon's economy and to our reputation around the country and the world.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Heath, you have been with us for several days now, very quietly watching. What would the Chief Financial Officer like to tell us?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. Oh. Patrick Heath with the Chief Financial Office. I have a brief presentation here I'd like to share with you. In the interest of the committee's time, I want to avoid covering topics that the department has covered in depth over the last few days.
Mr. Heath, how long are you going to run?
Co-Chair Gomberg, I can take 5 minutes, however long you'd like.
I'm going to ask you to hold, and I'm going to bring Representative McEwen up because okay. She's supposed to be someplace else as well.
And Chair Gomberg, I will be brief. Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Kathy McEwen. I represent House District 9 on the South Coast. And the first thing I'd like to do is give a shout out to Mr. Williams for the very quick, very quick response that Biz Oregon made when a small film was filmed down in Coos Bay over the last year or so and had an opportunity to go down to Sundance. They responded within a matter of just a couple of weeks and helped support their endeavor to go down and present their film in a venue that was really critical to them getting some traction and getting off the ground. And I can't tell you how appreciative our community is at the rapid and nimble response that they were able to mount to help that film be promoted. So I'm grateful to them. Again, Chair Gomberg and members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony. I am here in support of An initiative that is coming through Business Oregon, the Rural Opportunity Initiative, or it's nicknamed ROI. My community has been in an economic decline for 3 decades, not 10 years, and it is not privileged to have a robust economic upturn as the Valley and our metropolitan centers in Oregon have. We know in our small communities that our businesses are the backbone of our economy, but we continue to struggle, and we have entrepreneurs in our communities that struggle to have access to all of the amenities that are provided if you live near one of our flagship universities or live in our metropolitan area to access kind of the supports that we provide. So I'm very excited about this program. In Coos Bay, we're striving to create a one-stop shop for our entrepreneurs, and we do have a number of them. We have a facility that will come together to house training, classroom space, video teleconferencing capabilities. It will allow for connectivity between centers and trainings throughout the state. It will ensure that our entrepreneurs in rural areas of the state have the same access, training, and resources that those that live in the metro area do. And I think there are 3 hubs around the state where this is becoming viable, one on the coast. I believe there's one way over east, and I believe Klamath Falls is one. In Coos Bay, the initial seed money for this project was generated locally. It's been a very organic process. South Coast Development Council started this process. They've been able to secure commitments from other business development organizations to create this one-stop shop. OSU Extension is involved. The Coquel Economic Development Corporation, which is SEDCO, the economic development arm of the Coquel Tribe, the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw are involved and have skin in this game. The Coos Bay Downtown Association, the Building Permits Office, the Oregon Community Foundation is involved, and the City of Coos Bay has been key in helping kind of be the glue that pulls all of this together. These incubator hubs have a substantial impact on entrepreneurs and small businesses anywhere that new business ideas are being born, and again, they are happening in rural as well as our urban centers. And REEF, the local efforts that are able to compound in support of our small business efforts are really critical to our rural communities beginning to gain that traction to see economic vitality be returned to some of our rural communities. So I'm here today after having seen the momentum created by ROI in my community firsthand and ask for your support to continue Business Oregon's efforts to encourage entrepreneurship in rural Oregon. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for the representative? Thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you for your courtesy in allowing me to testify.
Well, we want to make sure you can get on your way in case you're holding a quorum someplace else. So, Mr. Heath, I'm going to bring you back, and as soon as you are finished, I'm going to bring up a first panel of in the public testimony, and I'm going to invite Mr. Jerry, Mr. Allen, and Mr. Gossian.
Gossian.
I was close. So, Mr. Heath, welcome back.
No,
in a moment. I'm going to let him finish first. These are necessary procedural steps that we need to go through, and I apologize for keeping everybody waiting. And I assure you that that even though we may run out of time for the committee, that I will stay on. I've cleared my calendar for another half hour so that I can continue to make sure that everybody who's traveled here gets a chance to present. Mr. Heath, for the record, are you still Mr. Heath?
Yes, I am, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. Patrick Heath, the Chief Financial Office. I have a short presentation on the governor's budget for Business Oregon. The department over the last few days has covered a lot of this material, and really in the interest of the committee's time, I just want to focus on 3 topics, the first being reductions taken in the governor's budget, 2 being where the governor is recommending investments, and then the 3rd, some adjustments to the governor's budget that we want to inform the committee of. So in terms of reductions, as the department has said, there's $8.7 million in general fund, lottery fund reductions, the largest of these being a $3.9 million reduction in the strategic reserve funds. The department has proposed a number of other reductions with respect to their planned reorganization and some other internal efficiencies. Business Oregon Inc. has reductions of $0.8 million over the prior biennium, and there's a few other smaller reductions that, again, the department has mentioned. Moving on, to investments. The governor's budget proposes investments in a few different areas, the first being one you just heard about, the Rural Entrepreneurship Initiative is what it was, the Rural Entrepreneurship Development Initiative is what it was called in the governor's budget. It's now being called the Rural Opportunity Initiative, and that's $1 million. The governor's budget invests $2.7 million in effecting the transfer of SELP from the Department of Energy to Business Oregon. There's $200,000 for a solar incentive program coordinator in the governor's budget to continue that work. There's $0.4 million in other funds for the Certification Office for Business Inclusion and Diversity staffing to staff that program adequately. And then finally, there's $500,000 for the Regional Accelerator and Innovation Network. The governor's budget also includes a number of bonding investments. There's $200 million in general obligation bonds for seismic investments. There's $40 million in the Infrastructure Revolving Loan Fund for Special Public Works. There's $10 million in funding for a levy sub-account of that program. There's $11 million in lottery bonds for regional solutions projects in 2017-19. And finally, there's $10 million in lottery bond proceeds for the Portland Harbor cleanup. In terms of other, there are a few other smaller changes that we made to, that we make statewide to all agencies to adjust DAS prices and charges, and those were also part of Business Oregon's budget. The last piece I want to talk to you briefly about is adjustments to the governor's budget. There are three adjustments to the governor's budget I'd like to make the committee aware of. The first being bond proceeds for regional solutions. They were just put into an incorrect budget structure, so we're asking that the proceeds be moved from the Business Innovation Trade Division to the Infrastructure Finance Authority. These next two adjustments, the second and third items, are both regional solutions projects that were approved by regional solutions in 2015-17, but at amounts that exceeded the legislatively approved budget for those projects. And we're requesting $500,000 for the Pacific Seafood Project in Warrenton in 2017-19 be added to the governor's budget, as well as an additional $300,000 for the rural infrastructure grants for the South Central region in the governor's budget. We're requesting an adjustment so that these two projects can go forward in the amounts approved by the Regional Solutions Committee. There's adequate lottery bonding capacity in 17-19 to affect these projects, and these amounts would be in addition to the $11 million approved in the governor's budget for Regional Solutions. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Any questions from the committee? I don't see any. I thank you very much, Mr. Heath. I'd like to invite our first panel to come up. And as they are coming up, I'll say that when these three have completed their testimony, I'll call on Mr. Wright, Mr. Kujala, and Mr. Findlay. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Who would like to go first?
Maybe, Mr. Chair, if I could insinuate myself into this. It's a special treat to have Adrian Allen here today. Adrian has come from Sheffield, England, to be here for a variety of activities talking about the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. He is the founder of that campus and really carries the vision for OMIC. We were just out in the hall, and I hope that you will share in your testimony the news clip from the UK that you showed me where Prime Minister May is talking about replicating the success of the Advanced Manufacturing Research Center worldwide, and that's what we're doing. Mr. Gary is a senior executive with the Boeing Company and represents sort of the big company benefit of what it is that we're trying to accomplish with the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. And with no disrespect to Mr. Goswain, he is the little companies in Oregon, and will testify to the amount of employees he has and why this is an opportunity for small manufacturers to flourish as well. But it's a special treat to have Adrian Allen here, who is the keeper of the vision for both the AMRC in Sheffield and OMIC.
Well, it's very nice, again, to have Mr. Allen back as well as this whole panel. Mr. Allen, I called you because you've driven the furthest to be with us today.
I think we can put in the record he didn't drive.
Gentlemen, again, who would like to go first?
A few words from Adrian, then?
Yeah, Adrian.
Well, yeah, first of all, thank you for those kind words as ever, Betsy. Look, I've been coming over here now for about 18 months.
Excuse me, Mr. Allen, we mentioned your name four times, but for the record, you need to tell us once again.
Oh, right. My name's Allen, Adrian Allen, A-L-L-E-N. I'm English. So, I've been coming over here for 18 months. We came up with a model, a professor friend of mine, in 2004, we opened a little center with just eight people on a piece of wasteland, a 400-acre piece of wasteland, an ex-coal mine that was shut when Margaret Thatcher closed the National Coal Board some 30-odd years ago. And in the space of, I'd say, 13 years, we've grown from eight people to well in excess of 1,100. I've got 6,500 masters or PhDs. I'm on a par with 2,500 employees at about 3.5, going on 4 times the national average wage. Every single one of those people that have invested in that area have come in for one primary reason. We've created this talent pool. Nobody's going to invest anywhere, in any region, anywhere in the world, if there isn't talent there. Just 2 weeks ago, I shared with Senator Johnson, and you've got to remember, Sheffield is not a car-making city. So 2 weeks ago, McLaren, who make million-dollar high-end production cars, invested in there, 60 million English, so post-Brexit, about $70-odd million. 250 young people to be employed over the next 2 years, making high-end production cars out of composite technology developed in the AMRC, my research center, the AMRC with Boeing. So we've had success stories about propagating and creating inward investment, all coming in around this catalytic research center. That research center wouldn't have come out without this company, Boeing. Boeing, because I was like a small to medium, I was the smallest business, you couldn't get any smaller, I was a one-man band, and I designed a way for cutting a high-end aerospace alloy called titanium, and I thought I'd go sort of like West Young Man and earn my millions selling to Boeing. Still to this day, I still haven't sold that solution to you, I might say, but not easy selling into big companies. But I did, on the back and the backing of Boeing, create this research center that truly set out to be a catalyst for attracting inward investment, attracting and keeping the best talent in my hometown of Sheffield. This model has been replicated or attempted to be replicated in 26 countries around the world. This is the only place that I and my colleague Keith, who founded the whole thing, are backing and supporting. So we literally have come over here. I think so far with, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, we've had some money from the government here.
We have. So
how much is it?
The state have been kind enough to provide us with $2.5 million for the R&D and
So we got $2.5 million from the state. I personally brought in, what, about $20 million of inward investment on the back of that. So if you're looking for a multiplier effect, we do it cubed, exponentially cubed, if you like. We've got commitment from major global companies to come in and put equipment in here, so that we can create a place that has the capacity, capability, and more importantly, the commitment to help develop young people and thereby introduce new tools, technologies into the existing and hopefully incoming industry that comes into high-value manufacturing around our center in Scappoose. So I put forward, and I'm backing and supporting you guys in your testimony to get large amount of money is the truth via Business Oregon, I must admit, but quite honestly, there's an awful lot of money coming in as we speak without any grant aid. And I don't think there's anywhere in the world, any academic institution you can find anywhere in the world that brings in $20 million, you know, without actually being given no money to help them do that. So, over to you.
Thank you, Adrian. Thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson. Good afternoon. Very much appreciate the opportunity to sit before you today. My name is William Gary. I'm from the Boeing Company. I might have to correct Senator Johnson. I'm not a star executive for the company, but rather someone who who understands the business and how to make opportunity grow in a technology space that is compelling to our aerospace manufacturing scheme. So thank you for allowing me today to provide testimony regarding the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center, which I will refer to going forward as OMIC. OMIC is a collaborative environment bringing together industry, higher education, and government in a partnership to develop new tools, techniques, and technologies to address near-term manufacturing challenges through applied research and advanced technical training. OMIC is modeled after the Advanced Manufacturing Research Center with the University with Boeing at the University of Sheffield, as my friend Adrian has shared with you. I have had the privilege of being involved with the AMRC for the 14 years of its existence, remembering quite well the day we walked out onto a muddy field and welcomed Prince Andrew to your shop to open the doors of a small and very austere building that today houses the manufacturing park that Mr. Allen has described. He doesn't lie when he says eight men, there was a dog, and they were in a shed on this dilapidated coal mine that was full of pestilence and certainly some national shame in the 93% unemployment that the region had suffered. The success of AMRC has been such that the Boeing Company has tasked me with the support from the AMRC, as Adrian described, to replicate this industry, academic, and government partnership 14 times globally, focusing on unique manufacturing expertise. So each time we've done this, it's been focused on a particular manufacturing or technical capability in a region that we wanted to capitalize on. OMIC is not only modeled after the AMRC, but it counts the AMRC as a very strong partner. I am proud to share with you that OMIC is the only U.S.-based replication of this model in the Boeing Company portfolio. OMIC will be a catalyst to enhance the competitiveness of the metals manufacturing industry, serving companies of all sizes. Metals manufacturing in Oregon is a sleeping giant. The timing for building the OMIC Innovation District is perfect. Advanced manufacturing sectors have forecast growth over the next 10 years. Regions and indeed nations around the world are competing to take advantage of the growth opportunities in this lucrative market. The aerospace sector is representative of this growth and has predicted record demand for aircraft over the next 10 years. The Boeing Company and other major OEM aerospace contractors have forecast up to 100% increase in forward orders, and there is an urgent need to expand capacity or increase productivity to hit increasing production rates and lower cost targets. This represents phenomenal opportunity for the U.S. manufacturing supply chain, and given its indigenous expertise in metallic aircraft structure manufacturing for Oregon and its metals cluster and associated industries in particular. You may not know this, but the Boeing plant in Gresham is one of the largest titanium machine shops in the world, employing 1,600 well-paid and highly skilled individuals, three shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In recent years, the facility has faced increased pressure from competition. To achieve long-term competitiveness, the Boeing Company seeks new and innovative tools, techniques, and technologies in support of production rate increases and cost reduction initiatives. Sticky pages here. As competitive pressures mount and the supply chain contracts, the Boeing Company has identified cost-saving opportunity in a vertical integration strategy that identifies critical assemblies and brings that work back into Boeing shops. First in this strategy is a focus on actuation systems, as Boeing Portland is the home of the Boeing Company's Actuation Systems Manufacturing Center of Excellence. This strategy will be the catalyst for increased economic opportunity in Oregon, creating a solid base for long-term work for the Boeing Portland factory. Yet, along with the good news comes the challenges. An aging workforce. 55% of the folks in the factory look a lot like me. And they were one bad meeting away from saying, I'm going to Arizona. Limited area for expansion. The Gresham plant currently is landlocked. and we are struggling for additional manufacturing space. The need for significant new capital investment. Rate increases that manufacturing rate increases that exceed the current capacity. The question arises, then, how do you compete with these challenges? The answer I put to you is technology. The Boeing Company has relied on the AMRC in Sheffield for 14 years to be the catalyst for the transition of these technologies into our manufacturing processes, flying cadres of technicians and engineers back and forth working on the solutions to our manufacturing challenges. With OMIC, we are positioning this resource 40 minutes from Portland Metro, providing an opportunity for the entire Oregon metals manufacturing community to have access to that magnificent AMRC-type resource. All industry, regardless of size, have similar pain points. To remain competitive, industry must have innovation, cleaner, leaner, and smarter technologies. We need to look at near-net shapes, new alloys, creative machining techniques, new cutting tools, innovative tooling strategies, and multifunctional machining centers. OMIC allows for manufacturing companies to combine resources to address these pains. OMIC R&D membership model provides a pathway for industry to engage multilaterally on critical technology needs, leveraging research and development spend in a collaborative environment. Past experience with this model demonstrates as much as a 25-to-1 research and development funding leverage. OMIC has 7 industry partners to date to launch this endeavor. Collectively, they have committed to invest $2.5 million in cash or in-kind services. This does not include interest from the international companies, as my friend Mr. Allen has pointed out, have pledged equipment valued at approximately $11.4 million, either donated or at a reduced price. Not to mention the international companies who have been contacting me since our first public announcement regarding OMIC and are waiting in the wings to become members of this exciting endeavor. Companies the likes of world-class machine tool builders, large original equipment manufacturers, and members of the global supply chain. This is significant in regards to the public-private investment model. A unified pathway and collaborative environment for applied R&D will also increase opportunities for Oregon's research institutions. OMIC will keep research and development in the state of Oregon rather than outsourcing it to to institutions outside the state. Our research partners, OSU, PSU, and Oregon Tech, will be recipients of the OMIC R&D Project Flow, providing access to real-world industrial challenges. Meaningful research and development projects will produce real solution and drive Oregon industrial competitiveness. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Business Oregon team for their continued support of this wonderful opportunity we call the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. OMIC is the essence of Business Oregon's mission to generate business growth and opportunity in the state, the likes of which has not been seen in Oregon. Already we are hearing from international companies with the interest of co-locating with OMIC to collaborate and create world-class innovation. With state and OBDD support, guidance, and leadership, these opportunities have a real chance of success, driving economic growth and shifting the industrial landscape of Oregon and the region. We ask for your support to continue the momentum that we have seen to date through the hard work of all the collaborative partners. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs. Is it Gomberg?
That's correct.
Okay. And Senator Johnson. That's easy. And it's good to see you, Representative Reardon. I'm Gary Gossoin, and we don't say it the French way, which you did, which is Gossoin. So we say Gossoin. My father, Charles Julius Gossoin, started Silver Eagle Company as an Oregon business to haul petroleum by truck. It was 1933 in the deepest part of the Depression. Dad was a hardworking innovator who sought like-minded people in industry, people like Leland James of Consolidated Freightways and John E. Beale of Beale Pipe and Tank, Oregon businesses. Well, disaster struck at Silver Eagle in the form of an accident in 1936. Our gasoline truck and trailer and its driver were destroyed by fire when it rolled down a hill and crashed in the Columbia River Gorge. Dad knew he could invent a superior suspension system. It tracked better, and he believed it would have prevented this accident. He began making it for our fleet in 1937. He received his first patent. John E. Beale noticed and asked him to manufacture the same for his trailer manufacturing lines. Other fleets did too. Portland was a good place to be. It had people willing to collaborate to improve safety, productivity, and employment.
A good example is Leland James, who chose to start Freightliner in 1942 because his ideas were too radical for the existing truck manufacturers to make. Proximity, familiarity, and collegiality fostered innovation, as it always has. And industry flourished here. But over time, our industries fell out of the limelight in Oregon. Georgia-Pacific packed up their headquarters and moved to Atlanta. Many others closed or moved away. Manufacturing began to be viewed as irrelevant or old-fashioned. Service industry, the knowledge economy, and high-tech were viewed to be our future. Traditional manufacturing was looked on as bad, and society could and maybe should live without it. Now, personally, I found this confusing. After all, we make products that are essential to people's daily lives and safety. Metal equipment for trucking and military. We bring in orders from national companies, give good jobs to local people, support our local supply base of materials, manufacturing supplies, components, and services. I wondered if I was missing something. Was I crazy or were others? Well, nowadays it seems that manufacturing is beginning to be recognized as a major contributor to the economy again. It's perfect for people who are craft-oriented, and particularly those who are STEAM or STEM-oriented. My small business, it's about 100 people currently. We've been as high as 350. We have to compete nationally with companies that have locations closer to the source supplies and the final customer destination. So therefore, my competitors have lower costs of operating and therefore lower prices. So to win business, we must be more creative, and we have to make superior products. And that's not easy. So over 10 years ago, many of us manufacturers formed the Manufacturing 21 Coalition, and we joined together and decided to tell our story about good-paying, creative, and fulfilling jobs in manufacturing. We focused on building a workforce for manufacturing and building capacity for applied research and development with our university partners. The Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center in Scappoose, or OMIC R&D, is not some flash-in-the-pan idea. It's been percolating for 10 years with many of us who are today's founding members of OMIC R&D. So we're asking that you fully fund Business Oregon's request for OMIC R&D to cover the administrative cost of this collaboration. And this is not corporate welfare. I know I've got Boeing on my left. This is synergistic teamwork between academia, industry, and government. And industry is waiting, as Adrian just shared with us, and Bill too, to invest large multiples of this request. So I ask you to help companies like ours, to help stay in business here, but thrive. You know, we all have much to gain or much to lose. So there's my prepared comments, but if I can just take a little more. I have huge passion about this. I think there's a whole underserved section of society, and I know Representative Reardon feels this way, that education hasn't helped them fulfill who they're wired to be. And then I mentioned those craft and STEAM and STEM folks. And we need them desperately in our manufacturing industries. And a place like this is going to be so cool. It's going to help those people see a future in this. And this is important work. And I know you get so many requests. I don't envy your jobs at all. So questions? Is that the appropriate thing now, Senator?
Any questions? Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Representative.
On the Boeing's need for land, How large of a parcels do you need, or how small can you use? Do you have any ballpark figures? And are you going to be locating at the Troutdale Industrial Park when that opens up?
At this point, the Oregon Gresham plant has no plans for land acquisition.
Okay.
We feel, and I rightly so, that technology, new unique processes, new equipment, and clever people will be able to push us to an opportunity to hit the cost marks and the rate marks that our airplane production facilities are demanding of us in the current footprint. Okay. The idea of a research facility that will allow us to push hard against those current constraints is where we're at today.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for your past contributions and, more importantly, for your future contributions.
Thank you.
So we'll, as I indicated, we're going to hear from Mr. Wright, Mr. Kajara, and Mr. Finley. And when they are finished on deck, we have Ms. Owen, Mr. Patterson, and Mr. Wagner.
He wasn't available, so I'm going to have to dash back up there.
Who wants to go first?
Go ahead.
Can I see it up?
Mr. Wright, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson. Good evening, members, or good afternoon, members of the committee here. Those gentlemen already left. I was going to tell them I have 400 acres of industrial land that I could sell them over in Reedsport, but I guess I lost that opportunity already. I'd also like to state that Representative McEwen was up here earlier, and we are in favor of that as well from a local community perspective, having those economic benefits benefits all of us, and especially our young entrepreneurs on the coast. I'm here because of a $10 million bond for...
Excuse me, Mr. Wright, I mentioned your name, but you have to do it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jonathan Wright, City of Reedsport.
Thank you.
And moving on, I do have a PowerPoint, and I will move through it lightning fast. So whenever you have a project, you always want to give it a cool title and a slogan, so it's kind of catchy there. So in other words, it's another levy project, and some of the folks in the room here have similar ones, and hopefully I can tee this up so it makes their presentations a little bit shorter. We are located, we are the toe in the sand for Douglas County out there on the coast. Why we're here is because we're all interested in protecting the public and the assets of the state, and because those folks over there told us that we needed to do all this stuff. And so what they told us we needed to do is under Code of Federal Regulations 44, and all those items listed down there, we have to analyze our levies for, and they give us specific standards, and that's actually a shot from recently down in California. So our project area is a highly developed urban area. It currently contains 400 low-income housing units. Those are a lot of them are subsidized. It has 250 low-income single-family dwellings, which have a value of $100,000 or less. It also contains every single governmental entity and asset within that region, as well as all of our fuel and food networks. It contains about a quarter of a mile of Highway 101, three quarters of a mile of Highway 101, three quarters of a mile of Highway 38, and three quarters of a mile of railroad line. It's also, I'm one of Caddy's economically depressed communities. We are a single industry community, and we have, according to the smart people smarter than I, a high social vulnerability here to any type of environmental devastation. We also have an extremely high unemployment rate and a median household income of $32,000. So what to expect if we had a major levee failure? According to the BCA that was conducted for the HUD grant, it would be a closure of the highway of around 3 months, especially since a lot of our vulnerable points for the levee system are because of our interaction with those highway facilities. An estimated total damage of around $30 million, and about 1,100 people would be homeless. And it would be all those high-risk folks. So what we've done so far is we are about 90% of the way through the preliminary analysis for what's called levy certification, which you're going to hear a lot about here today. And what we've done is we've managed to partner with a lot of great organizations, one of them being Infrastructure Finance Authority, in which we received a $50,000 grant, came here 2 years ago, gave similar testimony for a similar type of funding, and that was the result, which really helped us get to where we are today. So what we know at this moment is that we need to increase the height of our levee. A lot of our sections are below both the core requirements and the FEMA requirements. Some of the infrastructure needs to be upgraded or replaced, and a lot of the infrastructure around the highway intersections needs to be upgraded. Right now, if you look at our financial picture, we are the only community in Douglas County that's in full tax compression. Everybody's aware of Measure 5 and Measure 50. We have very little in the way of resources. Recently, we did manage to add a fee that got us up to a total debt service of about $50,000 per year. So if you look at, total annual investment of about $50,000 per year, total debt service capacity with a standard interest loan gets us to about $625,000. But our financial picture for the need is much higher. According to our engineer, I'm not going to go into this whole technical bulletin, but we have a very well-scoped project. We have identified all the elements of the project. Our project is shovel-ready. It upgrades the areas, and I'll go next slide here. You see the areas in red? Those are all the areas that are below the base flood elevation. So if I had a significant event right now, I would be hosed. The areas in yellow there are the areas that are above the 100-year floodplain but don't meet the core requirements. So part of our need is to elevate all those levee sections. Right now, we're just looking to elevate the most critical portions of them. And a lot of those, like I said, are around the intersections with Highway 101. So if you look at the alignment, oh, it's terrible. If you, you can see the big dip. That big dip is where the bridge is. And you can see at the end of the bridge there, it kind of dives off. Even more apparent is where it's kind of tilting off into the other side there. And that's right where the bridge intersects the levee. This is some of our highest cost area. Right now, if I had a flood, I would have to close the highway with sandbags. So right now, our estimated project cost to upgrade our levee to around the bridge sections and the critical areas is about $4 million. And so what we get in return for those types of investments, obviously we avoid the highway closure, we protect the state state's infrastructure, we also retain the labor force, which in this area our entire food and fuel system is located, as well as we protect all those vulnerable people. And we also avoid flood insurance, which is another issue that these gentlemen, I'm sure, are going to talk about. We estimated under Grim Water Act it would be about $1.5 million. I know bigger waters reduce that a little bit, but then it'll eventually get you back up to full actuarial. So I will stop. That's also from California recently.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Representative Reardon.
I asked my question because I have to leave, and I just want this one question. You mentioned flood insurance, which these gentlemen are going to talk about, but if the levies are raised, is that going to eliminate the requirement for flood insurance?
If we can achieve levy certification, which all those requirements are met, which would be this investment that we're looking for, then yes, they would not be required to have flood insurance. And if they wanted to purchase flood insurance, it's at a substantially lower rate. Right now, it's about $200 per unit, per household, to buy flood insurance in the downtown. If we are decertified, which we're provisionally accredited right now, it would go up to, depending on where your base flood elevation is, we estimated between $4,000 and $5,000 annually.
And that's what I'm hearing in my neighborhoods, too.
Yeah. And of course, that $1.5 million goes away from the state, away from us. It goes to the federal government. It doesn't stay locally to improve our levies.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Who'd like to go next?
Chair Gomberg and Co-Chair Johnson, my wonderful senator, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Wheel. I'm the mayor of the city of Warrenton, and I'm here to talk about HB 5025 and my support of it. So I drove down to Tillamook last Friday for the town halls for the Ways and Means Committee. Got there a few minutes late and signed up. There's a packed house.
You were the last guy that signed up.
And they cut my thing down to 2 minutes. I was all ready to go, and sure enough, 2.5 hours later, I didn't get called on. So just pretty much reinforced everything that I've learned over the last 5 years. Being mayor really doesn't get you very far. But I'll tell you, I really appreciate it.
I'm just going to interrupt to say that I did note you signed up second on our list today.
So. I wanted to make sure I got here early. But I really appreciated the outreach and doing the town halls because I think it's really a necessary way to get in touch with the communities that are in the rural areas especially. And I was also pleased to know that my 2 minutes from last Friday was going to get added to my testimony here today. Not true? Okay.
Well, you just have to look over your shoulder and make a decision.
Okay. Well, I wanted to say we've really, in Warrenton, benefited from the Regional Solutions Program, and whether it's the coordinating of the dredging project at the mouth of the Skipton River, and I think Mr. Heath was discussing the Pacific Seafoods rebuild and the effort to get them back on in processing in the city of Warrenton. I really appreciate the efforts that have been really spearheaded by the Regional Solutions team. Its mission and accessibility are something that I completely support, and of course the coordinator, Mark Ellsworth, couldn't be better. Denny Huell and Melanie Olson from Business Oregon are the two representatives to our area, as well as Jennifer Purcell from DEQ, Patrick Wingard from DLCD, Mary MacArthur from Colpac, Jay Pudwell from ODOT, and Kim Travis from Housing and Community Services. And really having all of these folks together and informed on the issues and in brainstorming on whatever that economic development project might be or the infrastructure issue that we might be having at the time, it really is invaluable, and you know, they do what their name implies. They find solutions. You know, we're currently working with the Regional Solutions to secure funding assistance for the geotechnical work needed for our levees. We have 10 miles of levees that need to get certified and accredited, and in order to do this, we must demonstrate to the Corps and FEMA that the levee is constructed out of the right material, that it's adequately compacted, that there isn't seepage underneath the levee, and I think this is kind of demonstrated. I know Reed Wagner is here from Multnomah County Drainage District, and I know they're doing a project on their levees at this time, drilling into the levee on, I think it's on Marine Drive, that they're doing that work right now. We have to do the same thing in Warrenton. Every 1,000 feet or so, you have to do a core sample and see what kind of materials there are and see if there's any significant moisture at the bottom of the levee. This is obviously highly specialized, and in order to get a contracted out to a geotechnical consultant, it's very expensive. We estimate that the work that we need to do for Warrenton is about $1 million. So Warrenton is applying for IFA loans through Regional Solutions in order to help subsidize the cost of all that work. In the meantime, our city engineer, Colin Stelzig, is working with utility and property owners to properly manage and remove encroachments, which means like power poles and garages and fences and docks and some other structures that have intruded into the levee. And we were fortunate to be able to use the Oregon National Guard to help rehab a section of the levee that had settled, and now it's back up to its original elevation. We're coordinating with Clatsop County Diking District Number 11, which is actually outside of the city limits, and we're working to annex them and bring them into our jurisdiction so we can work with them to get them accredited as well as the our rest of our levee system. Section 5 of the House Bill 5025 establishes the non-limited authority for expenditures for the public special public works fund. And as Jonathan was describing, you know, there's a lot to do on the levees. It's complicated and it's very expensive. Warrenton has 5,300 residents and 3,300 jobs, and we represent the largest employment in Clatsop County. We have the largest industrial area in Clatsop County, and we are integral to air transportation and commercial economies. Regional assets such as the Astoria Airport, the U.S. Coast Guard Base, Electro, City Hall, are all our first responders, and public works facilities, a grade school and a high school campus. All of these assets are within a flood-protected area. So I think that $11 million for Regional Solutions and $10 million for Special Public Works Fund is really only a start. I hate to say that, but I understand the economic climate we're in. I understand the difficult decisions that you all have to make, and we expect the Regional Solutions Program and Business Oregon to be significant partners with Warrenton in our levy accreditation effort in the years to come. And I can echo the insurance issue, because we did a survey, and we determined that the insurance premiums would be between $4 and $8 million each year that would be drained out of our community that we wouldn't be able to put into the construction and improvements that is really necessary for our levees. So that is a huge issue.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Yeah, any questions? Okay, thanks.
Mr. Finley.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Johnson and Domberg. My name is Lynn Finley. I'm the city manager for the city of Vail and the interim city manager for the city of Nessa. While I would love to talk about levies, which we have, I just want to say that we are in full support of Business Oregon budget, and here's why. We have significant infrastructure issues in both cities. Our water, because of the natural occurring arsenic levels, our water does not meet the EPA standards. Therefore, we must redo our water systems. And partnering with Business Oregon has been instrumental in our ability to get close. Between the two cities, we're about $16.5 million in projects that are either on the street or will be within the next week to resolve our problems and our issues. Issues that we could never come up with as a small cities. Business Oregon has come in and stood beside us and helped us work through problems. Loss of certification for HUD for low to moderate income. Environmental review clearances, when you have to go through a 1,000-page environmental review document and figure out whether it meets the requirements or not, Business Oregon has stood beside us completely and helped us with that. They couldn't more fully support that. Another option is my first experience with a one-stop meeting hosted by Business Oregon, where they come in and a team of experts walked us, both cities, through every process and scenario to fund our efforts and make it more cost-effective to us. It was an incredible event that was truly the savior for our infrastructure. So Project construction support has been amazing, and all the way through. I can't speak highly enough about how Business Oregon has partnered with us. As a small staff in the City Hall, we just don't have the expertise or technical capability or the staffing to do it, and without these partners, we would not be there. So I just want to say I appreciate their effort, and without them, we would not be able to survive. I would happily answer any questions you may have.
Well, any questions? Thank you for making the long trip over, and we appreciate all three of you today.
Great, thank you.
I'm going to bring the next group up, who I had identified a few minutes ago.
Mr. Chair, while the next group comes up, I promised Senator Hansel I would have it noted for the record that he had been called back to his district on an urgent matter, and so it's he's headed back to Pendleton.
All right. Well, I hope he travels safely. And welcome, gentlemen. Who'd like to go first?
I will. Bob Patterson, Public Works Director. Chair Gomberg, Chair Johnson, committee members. I'm here just to, again, provide testimony that we fully support Business Oregon, especially the IFA program. We also have levy issues for the City of Pendleton. We're finishing our certification run for FEMA certification. One of the key aspects that came out of our levy certification was finding out with the insurance companies, they don't look at just the base flood elevation or the 100-year event. They're addressing the 500-year event for flood protection of commercial facilities behind the levee. Fortunately, we do have that protection for our community. I really want to talk about recent years. We've done over $20 million in Business Oregon funding. Most of that in the last 10 years has been targeted towards our water system infrastructure. We were just approved for a $15 million loan. To get work going in addressing our aging assets in our community, along with capacity issues. Also, we've had a lot of work with Business Oregon Regional Solutions in regards to unmanned aerial systems development at our Pendleton Eastern Oregon Regional Airport. So with that, I just want to say I want to continue that support, look forward to Infrastructure Finance Authority and Regional Solutions continuing.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Please.
Co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Reed Wagner. I'm the executive director of the Multnomah County Drainage District and the three adjoining drainage districts to Multnomah County. Gosh, the city managers and mayor did a great job of explaining the issue. I'm going to tell you a little bit about our experience. We are about three-quarters of the way through the investigation, and as the mayor pointed out, Marine Drive is partially closed right now because we are doing the boring, so I would highly suggest an alternate route if you're going to be near the airport. But we protect a very critical part of the regional economy, including the Troutdale Industrial Park, which is expected to add another 6,000-plus family wage jobs in the area. When we were going through this discovery process, and many of the people who spoke here today, we reached out to, and we're learning this together, we realized what a huge undertaking we had, but we didn't have the governance or financial capacity to take it on. And so we brought together 14 of our regional public partners to try and come up with a solution. And not surprisingly, when it came to millions of dollars of need to start the investigation, we hit a snag. Nobody was able to stand up and say, we'll take on that responsibility ourselves. So but for Business Oregon stepping in and identifying a pathway or an avenue towards getting this investigation accomplished, we would not be on Marine Drive today and doing the work. And so I just want to thank the very professional staff of Business Oregon and just let you know how much we support Business Oregon's budget, and we hope you will as well.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner.
He neglected to mention they also protect PDX detail.
PDX, it's a small airport right behind the levee, yes.
Hello, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg and members of the committee. My name is Colin Rowan, Levee Ready Columbia project manager, and here with Reed Wagner, and I wanted to just add on a few things as far as supporting Business Oregon's budget ask, so the Infrastructure Finance Authority's Special Public Works Fund has been absolutely instrumental in allowing this group to come to the table for Levee Ready Columbia. Levees are indeed critical infrastructure for life safety and economic development in our region, and Business Oregon has been really critical in bringing people to the table, allowing them to actually come there first and then talk about sort of the financing. And that's through a special criteria that we're able to access, where 0% financing was given for $1 million of our $3.5 million ask. Indeed, the Business Oregon budget ask for the next fiscal year is to expand that pot, and so that more levied areas within our state are able to access that kind of special financing. So that was $1 million, and then $2 million of our $3.5 million Infrastructure Finance Authority loan, a very favorable funding. So that was incredible, but even more incredible is working with the Business Oregon staff. The regional representatives, all of the finance people, everyone made our projects better. If you've ever looked at any of their recommendation reports, you'll see that they take a truly deep dive into their studies. The recommendations they make made our projects more efficient, and the end results will be seen and benefit the whole state. So again, just to wrap up, please support HB 5025 and Business Oregon budget ask. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I might just add, because there's so much interest in levees today, water management devices in general are problematic for much of Oregon. And this morning, Chair Gomberg and I in Coastal Caucus learned that OWEB, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, is undertaking a survey of tide gates. And while it is not specific, it is ancillary to your concerns, and you might want to make contact with OWEB and see what they could do to help you.
Thank you very much.
Anything else?
Thank you all. Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's Michelle Owen here from Baker City. All right, let me invite John Charles, Robert Emmons, and Ann Carney.
Welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute. I have testified on this budget probably for the last decade. I'm not here to ask you for money. I'm here to help save you money. And I'm going to start my testimony by using some bad words, so just prepare yourself. Business energy tax credits, small-scale energy loan program, Cascade Grain, PAMCOR, Blue Heron Paper. I hope you recognize that those words all refer to vast amounts of tax money that left the building, never to be seen again through loan defaults and bankruptcies, because the state likes to pick winners and losers, or attempt to pick winners and losers through economic development programs. I think that's a very problematic approach, and I'm going to return to that shortly. I am going to address the three largest components of the proposed budget here and offer some observations. The largest by far is infrastructure, 67% of the expenditures if you approve it. And my basic question is why? Users of all infrastructure are generally identifiable. They're known. They are the beneficiaries, and they can pay directly. Just as an example, I am a fiduciary, a board member of a small drinking water district in Clackamas County. And when I say small, I mean micro. We have 62 homeowners, 62 ratepayers. And total revenue in a year is about $14,000. Now, you might think that we are one of the drinking water entities that would ask for a lifeline from the state when we have to do an upgrade. But that would be wrong. Actually, we have $242,000 cash in the bank and money markets and CDs, and we are now doing a capital upgrade that will be in excess of our current revenue. We never thought to take out loans. We never asked the state. We never went to the bond market. We've been saving for this for decades. That's why we have capital accounts. And I recognize that And the people who pay, they are the beneficiaries. They only pay $20 a month. That's our bill. And we're not going to raise it. They get a good deal. Well, I recognize that in some cases, there's a natural catastrophe or a regulatory requirement that compresses things so much that there's no feasible way for users to pay in the short term. But by and large, whether it's transit, roads, diking, drainage, vector control, fire, schools, users are known. You can collect user fees. You can collect a small surcharge and put it aside for a rainy day fund. And I'll just say that when the state makes it very clear that there's free or cheap money available here, you incentivize fiduciaries of those organizations to underprice, to procrastinate, to overextend themselves, and you basically create a moral hazard problem. And I think generally speaking, you should be very careful about creating a lot of cheap money for service districts. Second, on the business programs of the agency, that's 21% or $216 million that they're proposing to spend. We've been doing that for decades, and 20 years ago, in fact, Professor Anthony Ruffalo, an economics professor at Portland State, was paid by the state to study that very approach, and his brief conclusion was, at the time, quote, if you look at the huge amount of money that is spent or given away through incentives and the lack of evidence that it does any good, the conclusion is that incentives are mostly a waste of money. And I can tell you that Professor Ruffalo is now retired, but he's happily retired and living in Beaverton. And he'd be happy to come down and talk to you about the work that he felt was mostly ignored by his agency 20 years ago. There's also a lack of transparency. Maybe you've seen this 104-page PDF from my Oregon Inc. And it's got a lot of cool graphics and color and logos and stuff. And so I asked one of my research associates to spend about half a day digging in randomly to these projects that are funded by Onami, Otrati, OET, Best, and see what they're doing and what kind of return we're getting. Zero. I mean, you can't. Some of the websites are years old, Facebook pages with zero likes, no current information. It's impossible for a taxpayer to figure out what's going on with these projects. And it's not really an accident, I don't think. The Oregon Inc. has a 13-page strategic planning document on their website right now. And in page 9 of one, referring to Commercialization Fund Committee, a $5 million ask, they talk about this is similar to investments made previously by strategic SRCs, I forget what they stand for, Signature Research Centers, that's right. The nature of investments will remain the same and work to fill the valley of death in capital. Now, I've done a lot of promotional writing for my agency where 100% of our budget has to come from private investors. And I've never used the phrase valley of death to make it sound like investing with us is a really good deal. But it gets worse. The next paragraph, talking about Oregon Inc. having allocated money to Oregon Best and Onami to support early stage commercialization, says, quote, since the inception of these two funds, approximately $14 million has been invested. Neither fund currently has a mechanism to distribute returns to the state. In both cases, the state is the sole investor in the fund. So great, we're going to take taxpayer money, put them into the valley of death, and tell them it's a one-way street, you can't get back out. Why is that a good idea? Maybe I'm not sophisticated enough, but I just don't get it. And I think you should have a very frank conversation about that approach. I'll just wrap it up. Pretty soon here, debt service is either 10% or 19% of the budget, depending on which PowerPoint you use. I think this means you're overspending. 83% of all general fund money is going to be for debt service. 46% of all lottery money is for debt service on lottery bonds. You're proposing $445 million in GO bonds, $111 million in lottery revenue bonds. You know, you're just cannibalizing future money. So like ODOT, a whole bunch of money comes into ODOT and goes right back out to pay off bonds that were sold 10 years ago. I don't think that's prudent. So in summary, there's two paths. You can either spend a lot of time and effort picking winners and losers through grants, loans, tax credits, property tax abatements, and guaranteed markets for politically correct products, or you could dramatically improve the investment climate in the state, lower tax rates, fix Oregon's punitive and terminally dysfunctional land use regulatory system, so we wouldn't have to worry about whether there's enough land in a huge state like Oregon for a Boeing to buy. You could eliminate barriers to entry. You could repeal the nation's worst minimum wage law. You know, investment capital goes to where it is treated well. We should try treating it well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles.
Yes, Co-Chair.
While I don't disagree with some of Mr. Charles's conclusions, I want to point out a couple of things. One of them is that a lot of the debt service that the agency carries was dumped on it by the legislature or other entities. It was not initiated by OBDD, and it just ended up here. The second thing that I would say is that many of those failures that you ticked off in the beginning didn't emanate from OBDD. They came from the Department of Energy. And I just don't think that it's fair to blame all of those failures on this agency.
It's fair.
And last but not least, the state of Oregon, gave a modest tax incentive to a company that has just created 71 jobs in my district. And they are very appreciative for the fact that we have a very small toolbox of incentives, but we were able to keep that company from going to Washington. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Mr. Evans.
Hi. Right.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Gomberg and Johnson, for allowing me to be here today. I want to testify in support of Business Oregon. My name is Robert Emmons. I'm the Engineering Services Supervisor for the City of Lebanon. We did receive two loans from Business Oregon, Safe Drinking Water Loan and the Special Public Works Fund. Both loans totaled about $24 million. It was those two loans that were enabled the City of Lebanon to build, in the process of building, a new water treatment plant. So I will be brief. I won't go into a lot of depth about the new water treatment plant, but suffice to say, it's a much-needed plant. Our existing plant was served its useful life, and the new water treatment plant will be expandable to meet the needs well beyond the planning horizon, 50 years and plus. So I just want to thank the Business Oregon staff who worked with us, and I want to just say that I support the program and would love to answer any questions.
All right, thanks. We'll hold questions till the end of this panel. And Ms. Carney.
Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is Ann Carney Nelson. I'm a resident of Eugene, and I am Chief Operating Officer of the Corvallis-based startup Inpria Corporation. I'm here to show my support for both Onami and Business Oregon. Prior to moving to Oregon, I spent 9 years working in early-stage venture capital in California, so I've spent my entire life working with emerging technology companies. Inpria is developing electronic patterning materials called photoresists for the semiconductor industry. If you think of photo paper and the chemical that made it photoreactive, we do that for silicon wafers. This is a $2 billion global market, and we're looking to dominate the emerging leading edge, the advanced portion of the market, which is expected to be about $200 million in 2020. We have very strong industry support and interest. You can think of photoresists, or you can thank them for making the processing power in your smartphone, tablets, and laptops compact and affordable. We were founded in 2007, and as a university spin-out, companies of our sort typically take about 10 years to get from initial disclosure to first revenue. It's a true marathon. We are currently preparing for our initial manufacturing ramp, so you could say we're actually right on schedule. We are a rarity in our industry. We're a small company in a market dominated by large international corporations. Our competitors are primarily Japanese public companies. Our partners and customers are large multinational corporations. It's a classic case of David versus Goliath. We are a venture-backed startup. We've raised over $20 million in venture capital financing, largely from out-of-state strategic investors. However, funding for any semiconductor company, let alone a materials play, is extremely difficult due to these long technical development timelines. Even for these strategic investors, who are also potential customers, who understand our market very well, we had to make quite a bit of progress to prove out our technology before they would invest. And as such, our early grant financing, or funding, or gap fund, from Onami back around 2008, was absolutely vital to help us get started and to pass through that so-called valley of death. It supported our development until we could qualify for and receive a series of NSF grants and some other early partner support. If it had not been for this initial ONAMI funding, I strongly doubt I would be sitting here today. Since receiving those the early ONAMI funding, NSF funding, and our partner support, we've gone on to raise funding in three rounds from Intel Capital, Samsung Ventures, Applied Materials, TOK, the Oregon Angel Fund, and Band Gap Ventures. And we're currently raising another round of financing to support our manufacturing ramp. We currently have about 25 employees here in Oregon and are planning to grow to the mid-30s by the end of the year. We have stayed here in Oregon because of our proximity to key resources at Oregon State University, as well as to our key customer target and also investor Intel. Our core technical team consists of many Oregon State University graduates who live in Corvallis with their families and really wish to stay here. We have benefited from a number of ONAMI programs, including the Graduate Student Internship Program, facilities usage rebates, and most importantly, looking into the future, the ATAMI facilities build out, where we will be able to house our initial manufacturing pilot line. And I should add that we've had a very hard time finding appropriate lab space for our company, as well as manufacturing facilities. This space, we believe, will support our production demands for several years. In summary, Inpria Corporation is grateful for the broad support it has received from Skip Rung and then team of ONAMI, and we look forward to maintaining and growing our synergies in the future. Thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Co-chair.
What was the dollar amount of the grant from ONAMI?
It was about $250,000 over several tranches.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all again for being with us today. And I'm going to call Mr. Irvine and Mr. Gopalpur and Mr. Green. And while they're coming up, colleagues, I know we're running late. If you have a pressing commitment, please, we'll continue on, and we'll make sure we get all of this on the record. If those of you in the audience are just curious, I'll tell you that for purposes of our rules, we're required to have a quorum when we start, but once we have that quorum, we're allowed to keep going in an informational hearing, and that is exactly what we're doing. And as soon as these two leave the room, I will tell you that the three most important people are still here. So please, go right ahead.
Okay. Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson. My name is Sean Irvine. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Independence. And if you know anything about Independence, you know that we've been working about 20 years to revitalize our community. We've been really making a lot of good progress, doing a lot of good things, and I'm really excited to be here to speak in support of Business Oregon because they have really been with us every step of the way. I think we've probably accessed just about every program Business Oregon has to offer at one time or another, but I'm going to limit my comments to just a couple of them. I'd like to start with the Rural Opportunity Initiative that you heard about earlier. This is a program that I'm really excited about, something we've really found, you know, with our work in Independence is if you're doing economic development in a rural community, you really need to be flexible and you need to be able to leverage resources, put, you know, a lot of times resources outside your community. You know, we just don't have that critical mass to target a specific single sector of the economy. We have to be more agile and really take a grassroots approach and jump on opportunities as they come. And that's really why I'm excited about the ROI program. The opportunity to link with other resources that are outside the region, in, you know, the large populated areas like Portland, like Eugene, and even, you know, interesting things that are happening all the way across the state in eastern Oregon, you know, that's a real value add. In Independence, we're really well aligned. We've got everybody moving in the same direction. We know how to work with partners, and really we just need that kind of next step up of, okay, we're working well with the resources we have locally, we're working well regionally, what else is out there, what else can we use to help continue our progress. You know, we don't want to go reinventing the wheel with programs, we want to access existing programs that are here. So that's really why we're excited to support the ROI program and hope that we eventually can get involved with it. Speaking of flexibility, the other program I want to highlight is the Special Public Works Fund, and I want to use an example of flexibility to support that or that fund. About 2 years ago, we acquired a 20-acre site in the heart of our downtown, a former gravel site. It was a real mess, but we'd been planning for over 20 years to target this for redevelopment with mixed use in a way that would support both the downtown and the region. You know, we acquired the site, we cleaned it up. You know, we were into it about $1.5 million. Now we need to kind of take that last step and say, okay, we're going to build the infrastructure, the road, water, sewer, so that the developers will be interested in building what we really want them to build in the community, which is this great mixed-use development. You know, $2.5 million is a lot of money for a community like ours. Our urban renewal district met with the Special Public Works Fund and said, hey, we need to do this, but, you know, we're worried if, you know, we think we can sell this property to a developer soon enough to start the payback. We're worried about what happens if we don't. They said, okay, well, what do you think? What if we set up the terms? We give you 3 years to build the project and another 2 years of interest only before the full payments kick in. That gives you 5 years to find a quality developer to develop this site. You know, I really can't tell you how much that, what a relief that was for us. You know, we were talking to a couple different developers. We were pretty confident that we had one that was going to work out. But to really know that if the deal completely goes sideways, we don't just have to jump on the first opportunity that comes along. We can still look for the best quality solution for this project. That was a big help. We're already underway with that infrastructure. It's almost complete. We've actually signed a development agreement with a developer who's going to bring a 75-room boutique hotel to our 9,000-person downtown, along with a bunch of other residential uses. Going to bring $6 million in new spending to our community. It's a real big win, and I think a key to that was the SPWF folks being willing to be flexible with us. Just to wrap it up, I want to make a quick plug for the business development officers. They have always been a great resource for us. They are a link to the various programs throughout the state. They're a sounding board for our ideas that we have, and they really are the critical boots on the ground for Business Oregon, and I hope that you continue to support that program as well.
Thank you. Kath, nice to see you again.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, co-chairs, Representative Gomberg and Senator Johnson. My name is Kant Gopalpur, and I come here today wearing many hats. Just a little bit about myself. I'm a technology entrepreneur, been in the software space for about a little over 20 years. Currently invest in a lot of early stage startups in and around the Portland area. I've also been very involved with the startup ecosystem for the past 15 years, I believe. I also served as entrepreneur in residence for the agency's entrepreneurship and innovation division. And more recently, for almost the past year, I've been chair of the Business Oregon Development Commission. So I've had a pretty good perspective seeing it both from the inside and from the outside. And what I've seen, the more I've got involved with Business Oregon is there's been some great examples of the impact of Business Oregon and its various programs. I'm sure Director Harder and the agency staff have peppered you with all of the success stories over the past couple of days, so I won't go into a lot of detail about that. But really the goal is, at the end of the day, I believe, is to create jobs, but not just any job, is to create high-wage, sustainable jobs and jobs that will stay in Oregon and spur the overall economy. The work done by the Oregon Growth Board, the Oregon Innovation Council, the Western Juniper Project, upcoming ones like OMIC, all speak to this. I've also seen that the agency, and today's testimony bears that out as well, the agency appears to have an outsized influence outside of the metro areas, and it really does work where it's needed. And like I said, you know, the ultimate goal of this agency is to create sustainable highway jobs across the state. We've got to expand the economic growth beyond Portland and the metro areas, where I think have had a good run the past few years. But I believe it should be the agency's task to spread this to other parts of the state and also to across all demographics. Not everybody's succeeded or grown equally. So I think it really is part of the agency's job to spread that across all kind of demographics. Now coming to the upcoming biennium, I know it's good, there are a lot of budgetary constraints, and you guys are going to have a lot of challenges trying to make everything work. So there's going to be a lot of tough choices. But I would strongly urge you all to resist the temptation to cut, because at the end of the day, for economic growth, you do not gain by cutting. This is the time to invest. And you got to make smart investments. You got to make make sure that you deploy. We don't have abundant resources. I think we can all agree to that. But we've got to make sure we deploy those appropriately, make the right initiatives, and make sure we maximize the return on investment on these dollars. I'm happy to say that I believe the agency is in the right track. There's been a lot of changes made in the past 12 months. The agency's undergone some reorganization, and the current budget, I believe, reflects the goal of how do we create economic growth. I personally am very excited about some of the changes happening in Oregon Inc. as well. I think like any, whether it's public sector or private sector, there comes a time during the stage of any initiative that you got to step back, take a look, see what's working, see if it's working, see what's working, and then retool it. I believe a lot of that has been done with Oregon Inc. And a lot of the other programs as well in the state. I personally am really excited about what's happening in terms of advanced manufacturing and OMIC. I think that's going to be a huge boon for our state. And it's really part of the state's job, I believe, to provide the infrastructure and to step in where private capital will not step in. And I think that's what I believe the Oregon Inc. for folks were referring to when they're talking about the Valley of Death, because that's where public capital is needed. And then once the state makes those investments, I believe the public sector should get out of the way and let private sector take control, and that's what's happening. And that's really, I think we're on the track to do that, and that's what I'd like to see more of. So I'm here to make a plug for the current budget of Business Oregon. I'd be happy to take any questions.
We'll hold questions till the very end.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry, where are we at? Is it Mr. Green?
Nick Green. Chair Gomberg, Chair Johnson, thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to address you today. I'm here to testify on behalf of Business Oregon, HB 5025. I'd like to provide a little bit of context. I am the city manager for John Day City of 1,735 residents. We are the largest city in Grant County in eastern Oregon. We are entering our third straight decade of population decline. I've provided you with a set of metrics. If you've seen my written testimony, they should frighten you. They frighten me. This is an economy that is failing. At a time when Oregon has never been more prosperous, we have never been in worse shape. So what does that have to do with Business Oregon? They've been the only investor in our community. I'll give you two quick examples. Water system improvements, special public works fund loan. We spent $1.2 million on a 5% interest loan in 2002 that allowed us to develop our water capacity to 10 times our average daily use. We're positioned for growth with our water infrastructure. And because of the success of that program, we were able to repay the loan. We will have that loan paid off in 5 years. That's been a good program for us. The other one we used was the industrial park. This was 10 years ago. We came late to the game. I now own a 100-acre industrial park in a tax enterprise zone that has net the city exactly $0 in revenue. We built the Field of Dreams. Nobody came. So right now what I see is a $2 million liability that we could turn into an asset, but before we can do that, we need to remove some barriers to growth. The biggest barriers are broadband infrastructure. We have the second worst infrastructure in the state of Oregon. Our residents average 1.5 meg download speeds. To put that into context, if a gigabit internet were a 64-ounce soda, a grotesque amount of soda, I've got to go buy a new cup holder to hold it. The equivalent of that is a gigabit internet. In Bend, you can have Bend broadband at 300 meg download speeds. That's a 20-ounce soda. In John Day, we get 1/3 of a teaspoon, also known as a pinch. Just a pinch of internet to keep life interesting. I have an 11-year-old. He can't watch Netflix. If the neighbor's watching Netflix, the whole thing goes down. We've got to fix it. So to fix it, we need a strategic investor with patient capital who can come with us on the long haul. That investor has been in the past, and we hope will be in the future, Business Oregon. We're going to leverage Infrastructure Finance Authority. We're going to reinvent John Day and rebrand our community. Our goal is to become a leader in rural innovation. I've got a background in technology investment. I've got a master's in public administration. I believe that with the grassroots advocacy that we have in our community, we are positioned for growth. But to get there, we're going to need a significant investment from the state. So I'm here to testify on behalf of their budget. $50 million is a great place to start. I recognize, and I just left Senator Ferrioli's office. He is from John Day. I fully support his intention to bend the cost curve. I think we absolutely have to do that. We just need to recognize that if you bend it in John Day, you're going to own a failed city. That is not an outcome that any of us want. I think that we, working together, can create an environment where John Day can become a leader in rural innovation and become a gem for the state of Oregon. I'd like to take our story of failure and make it a story of success, but to do that, I'm going to need the support of the state legislature and of Business Oregon to accomplish that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Madam Co-Chair?
If I'm not mistaken, I think the state of Oregon has led to some of the travai in your town. Is it Burns or John Day that we with... I think it's Burns, that we withdrew the 50 contract employees and are bringing them back home. It's Burns, isn't it?
Are you referring to the public safety answering point or the dispatch call center?
OHA, Oregon Health Authority.
I can't speak to that. That was
wrong
not
town.
In Monday.
It's Burns. Okay.
But you are correct. It would be difficult to run a state office in our city. Many of the state programs and federal programs that oversee our area actually run out of Salem. So we need public sector stimulus and public sector investment. We have an aggressive strategy for growth. I want you to feel confident that we will put the state's money to good use. But as you heard Mr. Allen testify earlier, when you lack the human capital and when you're losing population, you're not going to attract private sector investment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Green.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your testimony and for your patience this afternoon. The last person I have signed up is Sean Holt. Is there anybody else that came to testify that wasn't on the list? Well, Mr. Holt, come on down and take us home.
Thanks for having me, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg. My name is Sean Huff, H-U-F-F.
Excuse me.
That's no problem. I'm the founder and president of a company in Portland called Growlerworks. And we make these things. I have a question for you, Chair Johnson and Gomberg, or yourselves, or do you know if any members of your committee are beer drinkers?
We may have heard rumors to that effect.
Okay. That's good. I am too.
I hesitate to say more on the record, but please continue with your testimony.
No problem. If you're wondering what this is, it's a product that we make called the U-Keg. It's a miniature keg that comes in half-gallon or one-gallon sizes, and it allows beer drinkers like yourselves to take home draft beer from breweries that we have many of here in Oregon and enjoy it over time, either at home or wherever you go, perhaps to lube up a productive political conversation. I'm here today to testify on how the Business Oregon programs benefited our company, and we were participated in the Small Business Expansion Program, which provided a term loan to my company, and that term loan allowed us to purchase inventory as we started to ramp up production. It was a very helpful piece of financing to my company when traditional banks would not loan money to us, so it was a gap financing or a bridge type of financing that helped us grow. Somebody mentioned earlier the multiplier effect. This ended up being a very important piece of financing for us because it also attracted a much larger debt facility from the private sector that we used to finance further inventory, and then it also attracted a $1.5 million equity investment in our company from outside investors. And those investors liked the fact that Business Oregon had supported us, and helped fuel our growth. We're up to 20 employees now in Southeast Portland, and we're continuing to grow. And so just wanted to say that Business Oregon was very helpful in helping to make that happen.
Well, thank you. Please.
Are you performing on your term loan?
Thank you for reminding me. That's the last thing I wanted to mention. So we have made all of our payments on time, and in addition, Business Oregon is earning a 20% IRR on that loan. It's about a 3.5-year loan.
And if I want to buy one of those for my favorite beer drinker, how much is it going to set me back?
So this is our UKEG 64-ounce model. This is $139, and you can get it on our website, Amazon, or Kitchen Caboodle locally in Portland.
I'm sorry, what was that webpage?
It's growlerworks.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm a quorum in my next committee.
Yes, I understand, and I'm on that committee as well, so I am right behind you.
All right, I'll wait for you.
No, please. I'm going to go ahead and conclude this public hearing. I want to thank the co-chair and staff for staying with us for an extra 35 minutes. I want to thank all of you that stayed with us. I appreciate the testimony. Mr. Bender, we will remind the other committee members that all of this testimony is going to be available in the OLIS, and that they can review that over the weekend as long as they're not in John Day, because we don't want to block out Netflix for all the neighbors. And with that being said, we are adjourned.